Hello?
Who's this?
Who are you trying to reach?
Wait, I was just wondering what you're doing tonight.
Just getting ready to listen to a podcast.
Ooh, you like podcasts? What's your favorite podcast?
Oh, just Percolated Media's Three Men in a Retrospective podcast where they look at various franchises one film at a time.
Really? Is that the one with Garrett, Adam, and Matt?
Yeah, this next month and a half, they'll be looking at the Scream series, where two of them haven't watched past the fourth film of the series.
You never told me your name.
Why do you want to know my name?
Because I want to know who I'm looking at.
Scream! Released December 20th, 1996. Budget on this was $15 million. Box office, $173 million. Wow. And this was directed by our old buddy Matt, the late, great Mr. Wes Craven. All right, before I get going on this particular movie, I want to tell a little story. I was in between girlfriends, and somebody on this podcast asked me to be a third wheel. All three of us were going to go see Halloween, The Curse of Michael Myers. Adam, do you remember this?
No.
Yes. You and I'll go ahead and say it because I want to bleep it out anyway, but you took me to The Curse of Michael Myers. Okay. We went to Halloween, The Curse of Michael Myers. We came out, and I looked at Adam and I said, horror is dead. I mean, there was nowhere else to go with these slasher villains. There was nowhere else to go with horror. Horror in the early to mid 90s, for the most part, yes, we can point to bumps in the road, but for the most part, horror was pretty bad. And then this movie comes out in December. By this point, I had a girlfriend, and me and Adam still had a girlfriend, so we went on a double date to see this movie, and we came out saying, holy shit, horror is back. Scream reignited the horror genre. I don't think there's any question about that. Before we get to all that and the making of this, I gotta go to our schedule maker, Mr. Matthew Goudreau. Matt, you and me covered this in a previous life. We have a new one coming out. Is that the reason we are revisiting this with our old buddy Adam here?
Well, you guys had girlfriends in 1996. I had a blanket that didn't leave my side. So that is certainly justification, because at the time we did Scream back at the old place, we only had four movies that were released. Five had not come out. So we will have in this redux done as many Scream sequels as we did back in the first one, 3 and 3. So that was ample justification, and the fact that by the time this is out, it will mark 30 years, 2026 versus 1996, made all the sense in the world. And we kind of needed a horror retrospective outside of Stephen King, because both Jaws and Predator have horror elements, but I wouldn't classify them as pure horror franchises. This is horror first and foremost, although there's a lot more to it than just a masked killer running around with a butcher's knife that we'll certainly get into.
All right. Now I got to get to the one who wasn't with us on that podcast, on that set of podcasts, Adam. Adam, I told the story of the first Scream. What is your history with the Scream franchise, sir?
First of all, in response to that first story, I got to say I picked better the second time we saw a Halloween movie together.
Yes, you did. Yeah, that was my first date. Yeah.
Yes, it was. Still got the picture.
Oh.
That time I was the third wheel. This is one where it was, I mean, you look at the time frame, you look at the year that it was. This was a big push at a time that I didn't think horror was going to rebound, going to come back. But I could not wait to see the first Scream. In relation to the rest of this series as we go along, I've seen Scream 2 once, and I've not seen a Scream movie past that.
Wow. We're back to Jaws.
So we're back to Jaws. Now, part of that reason, and I think it's going to inform so much of this, is I've seen every scary movie a few times.
Jesus.
And I will say I'm surprised how much I get confused over what's in what film, because this is going to start here. But Scream was a touchstone of a change, kind of the same way that The Matrix was, and some of that stuff coming out of the late 90s, early aughts. And I think this brought back stuff in a big bad way, and in a big good way. So I was massively looking forward to it. Obviously, the team that was involved, I was very, very hyped for.
Now, my history with Scream is kind of similar to Adam's in that I have seen two more than him, but none after that. I have seen the first four of this series, all in theaters, but the next four, obviously including the one that we're going to be covering, I have no idea what to expect. All I know is that Neve Campbell is back in the new one. That's all I know. I did see a trailer for the new Scream in front of The Running Man, but other than that, I have no idea what to expect with this Scream film. Now, Matt, you have seen all of them up till the new one, right?
Yes, I've seen 1 through 6, and I'm the only one who's seen 5 and 6, both literally and in theaters. And I was hyped for both of those, unlike both of you. So it's funny how, as I've gotten older, I've become more a fan of this franchise than I initially was for the longest of time.
Yeah, and I fell off after 4.
And part of that is also, for the record, I saw a Scary Movie before I ever saw any of the Scream films. And because of that, it's, to Adam's point, it's been hard to differentiate, but it's also kind of ruined a lot of scenes for me, but in the best of way, because I think that series fell off a cliff, but I still get a lot of enjoyment out of the first Scary Movie and parts of 2. I don't think 2 is very good, but the first one also is one of the few that really sticks to only one movie. It's 90% Scream, and then like 10% I Know What You Did Last Summer. So, but look, we're no stranger to Wes Craven movies, and hell, Scary Movie, I would say, is better than half the movies Craven actually directed.
I have to say that the three of us have to eventually cover Nightmare on Elm Street, because I see at least 2 fights on that series if we were to ever cover it.
Well, I already know where the problem is. I already know where you stand.
Yeah, understood. But
I can finish up the way that series would be, and we can get that out of the way right now, or I'll wait till we discuss it by the end of this film.
Okay. All right. Well, before I get to the movie, I have to kind of piggyback on my story to begin this podcast. Matt, by the mid-90s, the slashers that me and Adam grew up on, Freddy, Jason, Michael Myers, Leatherface that me and you covered, all of them had been passé. They were done. There was nowhere for horror to go. Would you agree that the mid-90s was kind of starved for something like Scream?
Well, if you look at the films that were released, and just the, when you look at the 80s in particular, there was just a smorgasbord of horror, not just slashers, every type of horror. You could find a whole shelf at Blockbuster of just that subgenre. They became a lot less scarce in the 90s, but I think a lot of that was because one of the things that hurt horror was how technology evolved. With CGI, you got to see a lot more in the Blockbuster genre, not the video store, to use that pun. But when you have movies like Terminator 2 and Jurassic Park that were landmarks for, you know, people going, oh my God, I've never seen something like this. Watching a horror movie feels, to your point, very passé. And the slashers in particular, you look at what the Halloween series began as with that first movie versus what it devolved into. And say what you want about Friday the 13th. I think the last one before this was Jason Goes to Hell. Mm-hmm. I think that came out before Scream. That movie is a lot more audacious than a lot of your prototypical slasher films. And Freddy had, ironically, Freddy is connected to this movie in a lot of ways. But to your point, slashers were either regressing, they lost their menace, they lost their way, and a lot of them lost their box office revenue, because let's not forget, around this time, Hellraiser was about to go direct-to-video and would never come back. Mm-hmm. Same with Leprechaun. So even your B-tier slashers were finding their ways to video stores, not multiplexes.
And it took a gentleman by the name of Kevin Williamson to change all that. By this time, Mr. Williamson, he'd done a few scripts here and there, but I didn't realize that he had actually written that one with Edward Brain Scan. I think he helped with that.
Yeah, he's a co-writer on it. I don't think he's the main writer.
No, Andrew Kevin Walker's the main writer, but he was like a co-writer on it. So he's sitting on a couch. He's not really making any money off screenwriting. He's house-sitting for somebody, and he sees a special on something called the Gainesville Ripper. He looks at this story. He looks at all the horror films that he grew up on, and he basically combined them, as well as his feelings on horror, into one script. And I remember reading Fangoria magazine at this time. This script that Williamson was very sought after, to the point where there was a huge article based on the fact that Oliver Stone was within inches of getting the rights to this. He was just about to buy the script, but here come the Weinsteins. And, you know, I gotta say this, boys. I was gonna kick the podcast off with this, but I'm gonna go ahead and get into this now. You know, Matt, since the last time you and I covered this series, is it safe to say, and I'll go to Matt first, is it safe to say that it's kind of taken a hit over the last decade or so? Not only did you have the Weinstein scandal, which uncovered so much shit around some of the actresses in this series, but you also have everything revolving around Melissa Barrera. She is not in this new one, so everybody's in a tizzy about that. Is it safe to say, Matt, that Scream is not looked as fondly upon as it used to be?
Well, you also had, there was the whole Neve Campbell controversy.
Yep.
That they weren't, I guess they weren't going to pay her what she wanted. I don't want to say that Scream is not looked as fondly upon as it used to be, but when you see the Miramax logo, it's impossible to not think of the negative connotations associated with that brand. But also, I think your franchise is going to take a hit anytime you, I would say once you get past like your third movie, it almost becomes a running joke. They're like, to the point where I think they were kind of embarrassed by it, much like Tom Cruise was with Mission Impossible, because Scream 5 was just called Scream. They didn't do SCRE5M or any of those gimmicky type of things, or call it Scream colon reboot. They just called it Scream, almost like to the uninitiated, oh, they remade it, which will be a fun conversation to have because you guys have not seen it, but in a lot of ways, though, I think Scream has rebounded because 5 and 6 did very well, much more than I thought they would, especially coming 10 years after, and they were not, obviously, Wes Craven's long gone. And I like the singularity now, though. Remember, those directors also didn't come back for 7. Now it's Kevin Williamson taking the helm.
Is he really directing this new one?
Yes, he's directing the new one. And I think there was some kind of dispute with the radio silence directors, which is why they didn't come back. But if you also remember, Christopher Landon was hired to direct number 7, but he left, and then Williamson came on to direct. So I'm very curious to talk about it, to see this new one, because it has Trainwreck written all over it, just based on everything that's happened.
Adam, what do you think, sir? Do you think that Scream has taken a hit based on its reputation the last 10 years or so?
New, and I think Matt hit it pretty perfectly. You could triple stamp everything for me on that. I think most horror franchises, I mean, look at Nightmare on Elm Street, look at Friday the 13th, look at, I don't want to say Hellraiser, because Hellraiser 3 is a dumpster fire, but 4 is good. But usually when you get to 3, that's about it. And then it becomes a joke. It becomes direct-to-video. It becomes nowadays streaming. And Scream fell into that, from what I understand, because they haven't seen it. And yeah, these last two seem to have really reinvigorated. I did think 5 was a reboot, so I guess maybe it is a rebootical. We'll see what happens there. But yeah, I do think this was looked at as a joke. I know we're going to discuss it about all of these. I think Scary Movie has almost got the bigger cultural touchstone after this first film, because this one is definitely, you know, it plants its flag. But I think that hurts. I think it's done some damage to the brand overall. I think as many people associate Ghostface with Scary Movie as they do with Scream, and I think Scream has fought hard to get it back, and I appreciate the hell out of Neve Campbell for being able and willing to stand up for herself, for the franchise, for women in Hollywood, and that it worked out in her favor.
I think another thing that has hurt the brand, sorry Garrett to cut you off, but when you see a franchise, let's look at 1 through 4, because those are your frame of reference, because those are the ones you've seen. There was a point where you were kind of like, okay, I get it's the same franchise, but do we have to keep bringing the same people back routinely? In the same way that Star Wars was like the Trinity, it's Arquette, it's Campbell, it's Cox. At some point, you're like, okay, can we do something different? Because the Nightmare films had recurring characters, but more often than not, there were new protagonists. and Friday the 13th, look, it was a different person every movie, because those movies are about Jason for all intents and purposes after a certain point. So maybe that kind of led to diminishing returns and why they felt the need to take 5 and 6 with new leads.
It hurts to hear you guys say that Scary Movie has overtaken us, because this movie started off as Scary Movie. The only reason it became Scary Movie is because the Weinsteins just branched it out and turned it into a comedy. This was the original Scary Movie. They were going to call this Scary Movie till the literal last minute when one of the Weinsteins
should have filed that trademark.
And then
it's funny that we get a Scream 7. Scary Movie 6 has also been announced.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
And the same way that Kevin Williamson's coming back, I guess the Wayans are involved again.
Oh my God.
You know, the new like grand nephew or something, like, yeah, they got a new generation of Wayans bringing it out.
Yeah, I think it's Damon's kid, maybe.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of the directors that were mentioned before Craven took the helm, because Craven turned this down a number of times before he finally took it. One of the names that was thrown around was Danny Boyle. Boy, oh boy. I don't know. I mean, after seeing 28 Days Later, I guess, but Matt, Danny Boyle slasher, I don't know about that.
Well, I'm glad it didn't happen, because we probably would have been denied Trainspotting. Mm-hmm. He would have had to not do that, so I think that worked out. But Boyle is so dynamic and diverse as a filmmaker that I could totally see him doing a straightforward slasher film. I mean, the last third of Sunshine turns into a slasher movie.
You know what? That's a good point. You're absolutely right. Much to its detriment, by the way.
It does, but I think as far as, like, my question is, how would he have handled the meta,
yeah,
you know, analytical side of this movie? Because that is the linchpin of this entire movie.
Someone who I think could have handled that very well, Sam Raimi, was also looked at to take this. You know,
I don't like cross-pollination, though, because it would have been weird. Sam Raimi, you know, the Evil Dead guy, then he becomes the Scream guy. Like, you shouldn't get two franchises in a genre. Like, that's almost, like, unfair.
Look at Craven, though. He gets Freddy in this.
You know? That's also true, but Craven also was like a, you know, he turned it down.
Yeah.
So
a gentleman that we're going to be talking about a lot, the more deeper we get into King, Mr. George A. Romero was mentioned. I think this had probably passed him by. I don't think he would have handled this very well.
Ghostface would not have been able to run. He would have just been a lumbering, you know, he would have been like Michael Myers.
Well done, sir. Well done. And then a guy who, you know, after Friday the 13th Part 6, I haven't seen too much of Tom McLaughlin's work other than Date with an Angel, but he was mentioned. And then, of course, you mentioned the Weinsteins. You got to mention Quentin Tarantino. He really wanted this, and the Weinsteins wouldn't let him have it. That would have been interesting.
Oh, God.
Yeah. I didn't say it was good. I said it would have been interesting. Adam, do you agree with that?
Yeah, go to Adam first, because yeah, I have words.
God, no. I think he was just looking at some of the young women on that they were going to hire, and he had his freaking Tarantino-ness out and about. No, absolutely not.
And
look, I love Tarantino. This is when he comes out, and I think he gets so far of his head up his own ass, because I'm going to make a movie, and you know what? And I'm going to do this, and I'm going to make an R-rated Star Trek, and this is the kind of movie I think is going to revolutionize cinema. No, fuck no. They'd be cutting off feet for 2 hours.
He was actually one of the few people who criticized the directing in this, believe it or not, when it was out. I think it was because he was kind of pissed he didn't get it, but he called Craven's directing tethered, in that he kept it grounded and actually kept the movie from being out of this world great. As it is, it was pretty good.
So the problem, yeah, I would have had with Tarantino if he did this is that it would not have been enough for him to just have the meta commentary and calling out cliches in the script. He would have been just stealing shots from, like, inserting Mario Bava. There would have been some Argento,
mm-hmm,
style in here. He might have even borrowed from De Palma. Like, I think it would have been not just derivative and commentative in the writing, it would have been in the directing as well. And by doing so, I think that would have taken away from the actual writing. It would have been too much of a distraction, and that would have been way too much inside baseball for your casual film fans. Because, you know, the writing in this, as we'll talk about, it calls out stuff that the general populace knows, not the, like, deep, you know, finite details that Tarantino jacks off to when talking about movies.
All right. Unless anyone has anything else to add, I want to go ahead and get into the plot. Adam, anything to add?
You like Scary Movies?
All right.
So I do have a spoiler question, because I never got confirmation on this. correct me if I'm wrong, it was not publicized that Drew Barrymore was killed in the opening,
no.
correct?
No, in no. fact, she was front and center on the poster. That poster, top bill. Yeah, that poster of her, of the woman with the hand over her mouth, that is Drew Barrymore. And if you see the poster of the cast, she is front and center in that particular poster. No, it was not advertised, and I want to get into it when we get into the scene, but that was her idea. And if I were her agent, I would have fucking strangled her and said, "No, you're not. You're going to be the main protagonist in this." No, it was her idea, and that's why Drew Barrymore is who she is.
Well, yeah. Well, that also makes sense because she's easily the biggest name.
Correct.
At this point.
Absolutely.
Because what was Friends on at this point?
Oh yeah, Friends was a few seasons in.
Like, I know Courtney Cox was. She was really the only other name that people would have known. I think Party 5 was just started because I think this was maybe after season 2.
Yeah,
because I knew of Neve Campbell, but I didn't watch it. But I knew who she was.
But you were the big Friends guy, and you used to watch Friends. Me and you used to watch Friends together, so I know that.
I still am. Yeah. Yeah, no, it's I got no shame there.
Uh-huh. So for the record, Party of Five and Friends, I just looked it up. Both premiered in 1994.
Oh, okay, okay. So they were both
okay. So yeah, just a few years in. Nice pivot.
I knew Friends started in. I've seen Friends, but I'm not. I couldn't tell you like. Okay. I wasn't a devotee. So I'm glad I looked that up. Okay, well, that makes sense. What the hell had David Arquette done?
David Arquette was in one movie with Drew Barrymore.
Getting ready to be a WCW world champion, yeah. baby.
Well, no, that was 4 years later. But
yeah, that was by the time the third one came out, and they should have promoted that as starring WCW world heavyweight champion David Arquette.
Star of Ready to Rumble.
We start off with Drew Barrymore answering a phone, and this was right after Drew went through a pretty bad period of her life. She was getting off an addiction to drugs, had written an autobiography, she did a movie called Poison Ivy, and a couple years later, here she is, the head of a new horror film, right? No, this is ingenious. Take an established star, a star that was reigniting her career, and put her in the opening scene to make people think she's going to be facing off against a horror villain. Matt, this is very Janet Leigh-esque, isn't it?
Right down to the blonde. That is entirely a purposeful thing. But I also like, for a director who was very against taking this project, he's also borrowing from himself, because one of the big parts of New Nightmare is Heather Langenkamp getting those phone calls.
Yep.
Good and, call. You know, being a stalker, which was sadly based on real life experiences with her. So I like that Craven is taking that, which was his last movie I think he did before this.
No, it was Vampire in Brooklyn. Was his last
one. Oh, Jesus.
Yes. Which me and Adam saw in theaters.
But I like that aspect of, you know, it's not just Williamson who's calling out. Craven is calling out his own previous work.
Good call. Yeah, I didn't catch that. Adam, go
Good
ahead.
Call. No pun intended.
No pun intended.
Now you just can't think the call is literally coming from inside the house. But this is, I got to say, quickest title I think I've ever seen in a movie. Freaking love it. Like, it comes up. Like, it's part of that initial production company, boom, scream, and then we're right into it. This is brilliant. It is, I mean, the theater just gets quiet, the lights go down, and this thing starts just creepy and eerily. There's no buildup. It's just, this phone rings, and you see Drew, and you're like, okay, we're going to start with our heroine. This is pretty masterful. And yeah, if you know all the other ones, it's Easter eggs galore. If not, it's just a great reinvention of horror cinema.
It starts off with a literal scream. It starts off with the title, literally. So I'm with you. I find that to be really great, as opposed to Predator Badlands, which you go about 20, 25 minutes before you finally get the fucking opening titles. You know, that's what movies do now. Here we have it right off the bat.
And there's also a lot of me remember Craven calling himself, the first Nightmare opens with a blonde
being chased.
And much like
yep.
another way this breaks from the trend, this is a very long opening scene. You know, it's about 15, bordering on 20 minutes from start to finish. That's a lot. Mm-hmm. That's a lot longer than the majority of slasher films. You know, I think about the opening of Halloween. It's a couple minutes. It's the tracking shot. Nightmare, it's a quick dream sequence. This is prolonged, and I think is the magic of the movie, is it perfectly balances scares and laughs. Because this is a great example of escalating tension, where it starts out playful and becomes much more sinister. I think it's one of the magics of this movie that is why it has had the longevity it does.
Yeah, the opening of this podcast plays off this exact scene. There's a reason why this scene is stamped in pop culture, is because of how well it's done. And I'm also going to say this, you know, the first 10 minutes of this film, I can't believe I'm going to say this, but I think it's some of the best directing of Craven's career. I love the way he cuts from the popcorn popping to her ongoing trauma. The way the conversation, as you mentioned, Matt, starts off playful and eventually turns chaotic and terrifying. This is damn good direction, and you got to credit Craven with that.
Yes, and I've routinely talked about Wes Craven in a negative light, but here's the dichotomy with Craven. You cannot overstate his importance to the genre, because he bucked the trend in three consecutive decades. Last House on the Left in the 70s, Nightmare in the 80s, Scream in the 90s. And his terrible movies, of which he made a lot, were not bad because of lack of ideas.
Correct. He just didn't know how to expand upon them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I'm so frustrated, is that he clearly had a vivid imagination. I just don't think he was always the most skilled at bringing those to their full potential. But here, he's able to, much like the first Nightmare, he's got a great premise that they're able to expand upon, and they establish rules.
Yes.
Which is very important, because a lot of Craven's other movies, you know, I think of stuff like Cursed, which ironically Kevin Williamson was involved in. You think of Vampire in Brooklyn. The rules of how the creatures work, or the horror, are not clearly defined.
Mm. So the conversation starts, and Drew is being asked what her favorite scary movie is. After being hung up on for dialing the wrong number, caller calls again, and he starts apologizing. And Craven's cutting to the outside, as it's a big house with a big yard. She's asking who it is as she makes popcorn to watch a scary movie. She says that her favorite scary movie is Halloween and A Nightmare on Elm Street. But as Drew says, the first one was great, but the rest sucked. which, you know what? Craven was hesitant to put in, but Williamson on the commentary is great. He goes, "Well, I just told Wes, isn't it true?" And Wes goes, "Yeah." And so he kept the line in, which I think is fantastic. Adam, go ahead.
This part of why I love this scene and this directing part of it, it almost feels separate from the rest of the film, in addition to the direction, but the sound that's going on, the Foley work, the popcorn, that it goes dead silent before that phone rings again, that it's almost a jump scare when that fucking phone goes off. But these are conversations that would be mimicked for decades and to this day. I mean, who doesn't at the beginning of the season pull out something and, you know, do you like scary movies? I mean, we still do this.
Yeah, we do.
But this, I'm going to say, I think it hurts the movie that it starts off this good, because it hooks you in and it can't keep up this pace, and it doesn't have to, but it doesn't keep up the quality either.
Well, I haven't seen the last few, but I do know that in the next they chase this a lot.
I mean, in this film alone,
yeah.
I think by the end of this film, you go, man, that beginning was something. And yep.
Well, these movies in a lot of ways have that in common with the James Bond franchise, where your cold open is more often a pretty extended sequence to varying degrees. And a lot of them are trying to sort of recapture the magic of some of the best ones to varying degrees, because I think this franchise runs the gambit in that regard. But the directing is also important, because Craven is very skilled in this opening with blocking.
Yes.
And establishing the layout of this house. And you also need to see the layout of the backyard before the big reveal.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is a movie that prides itself on being smarter than your average bear. And to do that, you need to establish, okay, why don't they just run out the front door? Like, you're sending out, you got to define your space and show, like, obstacles.
We've been complimenting a lot of the directing, which is very apropos, but I'm also going to compliment the writing, because you have to remember that this was very innovative at the time. We were a little less than 10 years removed from the height of the slasher craze, but us horror fans had never been called out like this on screen before, you know? So we just kind of looked at each other, me and Adam did, and we're like, wow, this is us. Like, mm-hmm. It's crazy.
Yeah, that's exactly right, is you suddenly feel like the movie's talking to you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's why I feel like Wes Craven is the perfect choice for this. I think Sam Raimi is really the only other one that would do it, just because of their attachment to horror and what they mean to the genre.
Well, it's also we also take for granted the idea of what meta means.
Mm-hmm.
And that commentary, you know, nowadays it's become a joke. And it's been, in the same way that slasher films became watered down, the whole meta aspect of being self-reflective in screenwriting, that's gone very numb. So that's, you have to put yourself back in 1996. This was almost revolutionary because when movies talk to the audience, they literally broke the fourth wall more often than not, like the ending of Goodfellas.
And there's even nice touches, like when Drew's like, my favorite horror movie is Halloween, as she's pulling out the butcher knife. Like that kind of stuff was the stuff that horror fans looked at and were like, oh, wow, like she's talking to us. So the conversation continues and Drew starts getting a little worried when the person on the other end wants to know her name because he wants to know who he's looking at. So Craven's amping the tension as we hear a dog barking, causing more unease, and Drew gets warned to not hang up on him. She does, and he calls back to say that he just wants to talk, so she hangs up again. Phone rings again, and he says that if she hangs up on him again, he will gut her like a fish. Also, it has to be mentioned that the voice actor here, the guy doing the voices, I think he's very good on the other end of this line. I know they play with this a lot. Again, I don't know about the last few, but Adam, would you agree that just the voice on this line is just as scary as what happens on screen, right?
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely horrifying. But I do think it gets clear fairly early into the film that our two antagonists are definitely not the ones that could be making this call. Even with a voice changer, they could not sound this menacing.
I don't know. Matthew Lillard's a pretty prominent voice actor.
I was about ready to say, I've seen Matthew Lillard at cons. He can be pretty fucking intimidating. So Drew runs.
But you're right. Also, one thing to note that, you know, Wes Craven, with Nightmare, you had a slasher villain that was very vocal and animated,
yep.
Which was mm-hmm. different from your Michaels and your Jason. So bringing that and merging it with the masked killer, which more often than not did not speak, is also kind of a landmark fusion.
Drew runs and locks the doors as he asks if she can see him. He says that the police won't get there in time and he wants to see what her insides look like, just continuing to make this poor girl suffer. The doorbell
line.
Yeah.
That line that somebody wrote that it mm-hmm. passed it and it got in here. That throughout all of this, that line just creeped me out so much. Mm-hmm. It's just, there is something utterly evil. I mean, that's a pinhead kind of line.
Mm-hmm. Always take
that's also my problem with how censorship and the MPAA functions, because with written words, they'll give it a pass more often than not. But all of their fights were about the physical, visible violence mm-hmm. that Craven had to fight against with trying to get this movie an R rating.
Yeah, this movie took a beating from the MPAA.
Which makes no sense to me because you look at what happened with like Friday the 13th Part 7.
Yep.
Where that movie is almost bloodless for a Friday the 13th movie. And they had such a hard-on for that particular one. But look at some of the movies that the fact that Natural Born Killers was not NC-17.
Yeah.
You look at how shocking a lot of violence was getting in the night. I mean, look at the year before this, you had Casino, which, again, also should have been NC-17 with the 1-2 punch of someone's eyeball being exploding out of their socket thanks to a press.
Mm-hmm.
And the scene at the end where they're almost beaten to death in the cornfield and buried.
That's why something like Silence of the Lambs was so innovative, was because you took a pristine stars and director and you put them at the helm of a horror film, and that's what took it out of the ghetto. You know, you put it on screen and it wins Oscars. Yeah, I agree with you, and I think it goes further than that, though, guys, because Craven had a hell of a time with the school board in this film as well, because they were all set to shoot at the school, and then there's an awesome credit, if you look at the credits.
Yes, that says, there is.
No thanks to the Santa Rosa school board, because at the last minute they said, yeah, we don't want this on our campus because of the content of the script, and so they had to scramble to find a school to fit this. So, I mean, horror, the slasher genre, horror in general, had such a reputation that nobody wanted a piece of this, even the school board where they were going
to
shoot.
Well, there was no prestige to it anymore. The days of something like Halloween, which was very articulately made, and it's not especially showy with the violence. And when you have something like Silence of the Lambs, which was really revolutionary in the way it was lauded for the genre, people only looked at horror in a positive light if you made movies like that.
Correct.
Not going back to the well of watching somebody stab teenagers.
So the doorbell rings and Drew asks who's there, and the person on the other end says, you never ask who's there. Again, another call out to horror fans. She also says that she has a boyfriend who's big and he plays football and will kick the shit out of you. So we think that she's lying about this, right? She even says his name as she turns on the light, and there he is tied to a chair. So Matt, there's your reveal, right?
Yep. And it's also one of the things that I really applaud this movie for are it'd be very easy for the third act reveal of this movie to just be them saying, we did this, we did this. I tied him up when I killed Casey. Like, they never explain who does what 100%, but it's also plausible because it makes you realize it has to be two killers just based on how this scene is playing out.
Yes. That's the brilliance of it, and that's what makes it so rewatchable, is you watch it saying, okay, who did this? Who did this? And you're right. Like, they give it away that there's two killers. You just don't realize it as you're watching it.
Yeah, and you know when it's revealed, they're like, oh, that actually makes sense. Like, it's not just a reveal for the sake of a reveal. But also in the movie, one of the smart things also, the red herring is not a red herring.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, we'll get there. I also want to say, too, I think Drew is very good here. She had that role in Poison Ivy. Yeah, I guess that was kind of a comeback, but this was her true comeback, wasn't it, Adam?
It was. I mean, this wasn't too far removed from David Letterman and that appearance where everybody was like, oh, my God, she is. I hate to compare because it's only done to women, you know, but it was like that Britney type of phase where people were like, you know, has she gone too far where she needs professional help? And she was a child and she was born and bred into the industry. She has gone through so freaking much. And I was glad that this went the way that it did. I was glad that she got noticed and notoriety in a positive way immediately for this, because I think it helped turn things around. She wasn't completely, I don't want to say fixed because that seems demeaning, but I think it helped her get over so many of the demons that she had to battle.
Well, I think it also helped her.
She's just fucking good.
I think it also helped her become more marketable in the eyes of studios, because right after this, she did Wedding Singer.
Yep.
Oh, her and Adam Sandler trilogy is just chef's kiss.
I like 2/3 of it. That last one blended was fucking garbage.
Oh my God.
So fun.
That's 3 more Adam Sandler movies than I like. The caller says that she needs to play a game with him or her boyfriend gets it, as she says.
All I keep thinking of nowadays is freaking Jigsaw when I hear Saw, I want to play a game.
Of course. She turns out the light and he says that he'll ask some horror questions about some movie trivia. He gives the example of Halloween, which she answers correctly. But the Friday the 13th question, she gets wrong, as most people did, because Jason became the face, but his mom was the original killer. Again, a call out that I would scream when I was a teenager that no, Jason was not the original killer, it was his mom. And here's Kevin Williamson to call that out.
This is bar trivia night.
Yes.
Like, just that one thing that would get everybody, that now everybody who thinks they're cool is like, well, actually, but back in the day, yeah, this was just one of those things that was great. And it's such a inside the movie, inside the horror kind of stuff. This feels like it's talking to us, just horror nerds that are coming to see this.
I also love how he attacks her in the way that like entitled fans would, where it's like, no, you're wrong, and I'm gonna prove how dumb you are by mansplaining to you. Also
mansplains over this phone.
So they gut poor Steve in his chair, which causes Drew to just kneel down and cry, and she's asking the person on the other end to leave her alone, and the question becomes, what door am I in? And this, Matt, this is what gives away that there's two killers, because no matter what she chooses, she's wrong, right?
Yes. But it's also a good reference to When a Stranger Calls.
Good. Yes, very good call.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's literally the big twist in that movie is, oh, the killer's in the house.
Yep.
And this movie opens with a stranger calling.
Yeah.
So I love, this movie has more layers than an onion, but I never feel like I'm being browbeaten.
Or in the talked way that, down like, to.
Yeah, yeah, or demeaned.
Yes.
Like, which, again, if Tarantino directed this, it would have been just him bludgeoning you over the head with a projector.
So Drew picks up a knife as she backs out of the house with phone in hand. She glances in and sees something move across the room as her parents are pulling up. So this I also like too. And goddamn, we are really dissecting this opening scene. It's taken about 40 minutes of this podcast, but
you have to. It's like when you talk about The Exorcist, you have to talk about the big possessions.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, what I love about seeing her parents pull up is we assume this means that she's safe. Adam, that's not the case, is it?
It's not, but you know that it is. The parents arrive, the killers are going to flee, and this is what's kicking it off, and she's our heroine throughout the rest of this film.
Yep.
Let's flip that right on its head right away, and it is amazingly done. Like, this is frightening.
Yeah, you think it's the immediate security. This is like the Ultimate Warrior running in at the end of WrestleMania 8.
Jesus Christ.
Except, it's, you know, you could argue there's as big of a botched finish in this case as there was in that.
Except he's instance. On time.
Ghostface, they arrived in time, and it's too late.
Yep, Ghostface is right there and appears in the window. Which, by the way, this was actually Craven donning the mask for this one shot of him in the window right by Drew. He then jumps through another window before chasing her down and choking and knifing her to death. All this as her parents are walking in.
Mm-hmm.
Very harrowing. And what I also like about this is she knows who it is because she actually pulls the mask off. So she sees who it is as the knife comes down and her parents don't see, but hear her stabbed to death through the phone. Another harrowing thing. You are hearing your daughter be killed over a phone line. You are not seeing it. Harrowing, scary stuff that I don't think it's talked about enough with how good of a movie this is and how good of a scene this is.
I agree. And there's a lot more than just what we know of in here. Like when we see Steve, when that light gets turned back on, he is literally disemboweled.
Yeah.
Like his guts are pouring out the front of him onto the ground. Like that is, I can't believe they actually were able to pull that off. And this, just the father listening while she's getting gutted is so over the top, horrific, wonderfully done. It is nuts. I mean, there is so many great shots in this beginning and so many good choices.
Yeah, I also appreciate that one of the things this movie could comment on but doesn't are knives are so passe. It's all about guns now.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God, yeah.
Especially at this time.
Oh, yeah. The mom sees Drew hung from a tree, and that's how we start, boys. That is our opening scene. Holy shit.
With a second disemboweling in the opening 15 minutes.
There's more disemboweling in this opening than going to your local Chipotle on Friday night and being the guy who has to clean the bathrooms.
I hate when I go to Matt and I regret doing it. We then cut
to... You didn't go to me. I just interrupted you because I knew it would piss you off.
We then cut to good old Sydney Prescott as she's typing in a computer and her boyfriend, who looks suspiciously like Johnny Depp from Nightmare 1, come up very Depp-like through her window as her dad walks in her room saying that he swore he heard something. So here we have Skeet Ulrich as Billy... Adam, straight up Johnny Depp ripoff here, right?
All the way down to his clothes, his hair. I mean, you do everything but put him in that Johnny Depp, no, I swear I'm not really gay, crop top from Nightmare 1. So I watched part of this with my daughter, and because she had recently watched all these over the Halloween season. Heaven forbid I watch them with her and I'm caught up to date. So we're watching this, and I make a reference to Johnny Depp, and she's like, huh? I go, he's just so Johnny Depp in this. She goes, what do you mean? She hasn't seen Nightmare, I realize, and we're fixing that soon. So I Google it to Image Search, and she is blown away. And so we start going down that rabbit hole of everything that Wes Craven means to both franchises. And this, it is, I mean, it's deliberate. It goes a little too far. Because when even your hair is styled that way, when the clothes are done that way, look, Skeet Ulrich is no Johnny Depp.
Oof.
Yeah. Every woman on the planet has said that.
Yeah. The other thing about Skeet Ulrich in this, before I go to Matt, I have to say this. You know, in looking at, I looked at a ton of making ofs for this, boys. And in hearing him be interviewed, I don't think he, in fact, he flat out admits that he didn't realize what movie he was in. Because he took this so serious that, you know, he's studying serial killers. He's studying, like, okay, I know I'm going to be the killer in this. So I have to know what these mannerisms are, this mannerism is. I don't think he gets the script. And I think he has the look. But, Matt, is his acting just kind of off in this?
Well, I don't know if it's off as much as it is the fact that it's playing into archetypes and subverting them, because he's the closest thing to the jock of this group, even though he's not an athlete because he's like, what, 5'5"?
Like, Johnny Depp.
Forget Johnny Depp. He reminds me a lot of Tom Cruise in this.
Mm, yeah.
But to the Depp point, at the end of the movie, that t-shirt jeans with the hair, that's right out of Crybaby.
Mm-hmm.
Not just Nightmare. So I like that he's playing it straight, because one of the things that this movie does is it has all the components of big, not just horror films, but like teen movies, because there's a lot of melodrama that's played really straight, but it's important to do that because it feels authentic to, like, these feel like actual teenagers in a genre where more often than not, that wasn't the case.
Yeah, and based on who else we get throughout the course of this film, I do think we need that straight man that he's playing.
Although in Scary Movie, he's gay. Which is one of my favorite reveals.
Yes.
Billy has a pickup line that I actually put in my notebook where he says that The Exorcist was on TV, which made him think of her.
Yeah, I think Beetlejuice said the same thing.
That was a weird line.
Well, that line doesn't work.
he says it was the TV version, which means that their love affair started off so hot and heavy, but it has turned into the TV version of what it used to be. And we are setting up the virginal girl losing her virginity here, which if you watch horror up to this point, you know that the girl who's not the virgin gets killed. So I think this is more just good writing from Williamson.
Yeah, it's nodding to those horror tropes without making it so blatant that you would roll your eyes until later.
So Sydney pushes him off, saying, "Do you know what my dad would do to you if he saw you?" And he leaves as she flashes him, turning the relationship into a PG-13 one.
Well, that's also a big thing in these slasher films are the overprotective parents.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he might as well be played by John Saxton.
Well, you have to realize, too, that parents in these movies were almost non-existent. So the fact that parents play so much into this movie was kind of a throw-off for me back in 96.
That's also subversion because, to your point, the parents were an afterthought in these movies. And when they were, they gave horrendous performances like the mom in Nightmare on Elm Street. And here, not only do the parents feel like actual characters, they're integral to the modus operandi of the killers. At least one of them. Like, that's never a correlation that's made in these movies. In Freddy's case, it was, but not with the teenagers, necessarily.
We then cut to outside the school as cops are roaming around and Sydney runs into her friends as Gail Weathers, Courtney Cox herself, is giving a news update. Okay, a couple
things. Because when a story breaks, she'll be there for you.
My God. Okay, a couple things about this. One, not that joke. One, Rose McGowan as Tatum, I think is very good. I like seeing her bounce off Campbell the way she does. I think they have good chemistry. And two, Gail Weathers, friend zone, Courtney Cox. Adam, we spoke back when we did Predator 2 that Morton Downey Jr. played a tabloid reporter with a show right before all that became chic. Here, we are right in the thick of that tabloid TV height, aren't we?
I mean, yeah, she might as well go ahead and keep that hard copy and put it right on with this. I mean, this is TMZ before TMZ. And what school invites these kind of reporters on campus? She's just wandering around with these kids like nothing else. But to your point, yes, I also like watching Rose McGowan bounce around.
So the movie is a staunch criticism of tabloid media. I don't get the sense they were invited. They just showed up because they heard it through the grapevine.
Yeah, that's what I get too.
And they treat violence as spectacle because it's publicity, it's coverage, it gets your name out there. You know, because Gail, this is also a reflection of the media turning the whole O.J. Simpson case into the trial of the century. Like, you had every local news station just swarming the courtroom because they wanted to be the first people there. And obviously, this is a few years before Columbine, so it doesn't have that hanging over its head.
A few years before Columbine, but it was 1 year before Princess Diana's death. And tabloids were blamed for that because it was the result of a car chase that happened. So, yeah, tabloids were not looked good on, as we mentioned when we did Predator 2. But I give props to Courtney Cox because she really had to fight for this role. She was looked at as the good friend, right? Like, everybody loved her on Friends, and so they didn't think that she could pull this off. But I think she pulls this off very well. Adam, as the big Friends fan, how do you think she does as opposite her particular role on Friends?
Look, she's my favorite female character on Friends. I know Garrett kind of wishes that we had Phoebe here instead.
Kinda.
Which one's Phoebe? Is Phoebe Jennifer Aniston?
No, she's Lisa Kudrow.
Oh, that's Rachel.
Lisa Kudrow. All right, going back to a fight for 25 years ago. But I think she does a good job in this film. We are going to rehash this later down the road. I remember that much, at least, not to pivot away from it. But I think it was also kind of good on her point to say, I got to do something different from Friends, or that's all I'm ever going to be remembered for. I still think that's all she's ever going to be remembered for, Cougar Town notwithstanding, but I think she does a good job. Again, it is hard to see this in the realm of Scary Movie, though. I thought this character was a lot worse and a lot more of a parody, but it's because of what I know comes later down the road. In this first film, both her and Dewey, which you're going to get ready to introduce, are not nearly as bad as we get later.
I also like that she's not afraid to play Gail as just a bitch.
Same. Yeah. Like, I love that too.
And they kind of, one of the things that this franchise does, as we'll talk about, they soften her up considerably. Some films more than others, but I like that here she's kind of, outside of Ghostface, she's the most hated character.
Yes.
She's like the Professor Umbridge of this franchise. It's like you got Voldemort standing right there, but you hate the teacher who's running the school like Auschwitz.
So she really doesn't have a redeeming side in this, and no. I dig that.
Tatum is telling Sydney about Casey's death and that the police are questioning the entire school, and we are getting hints of her mom's backstory as Tatum says, this is even worse than, and then she stops herself.
God, that's freaking family, setting up a Family Guy cutaway.
We see the Fonz, Henry Winkler. He sends Sydney to questioning as the sheriff and Deputy Dewey Riley interrogate her a bit about Casey. All right, so Dewey, this guy, I think, is very well known at this point that this character was written to be the jock of this film. And Arquette was cast as one of the teens, but he was like, you know what? I think I could play this role and I can think I can do it well. You needed David Arquette here to kind of add some levity to what is going on with the teens. I think he is just goofy enough, and I think he plays this role pretty damn well. Don't remember much about the sequels, but I'll say for this movie, I like him quite a bit.
I think he's serviceable, but in the same way that the ghost face mask I associate with Scary Movie, all I think of is the way they parody this character in Scary Movie. And it's, there are parts that are almost indistinguishable because I feel like the movie has enough strong characters with comedic timing that he feels like a parody by comparison, ironically.
Interesting.
And but this is also kind of a subversion of usually in slasher films, the sheriff is a tough guy.
Yep.
Or an expert, like you have the hunter guy from Jason Goes to Hell, or you have Sheriff Brackett in Halloween, where he's an older guy who's seen it all. This, you got a young hotshot. But he's also not as incompetent as those dipshits from Last House on the Left.
Oh.
So maybe this is Craven kind of rectifying that in a certain way. But I've never felt David Arquette was great. But I've said that about everything he's ever done. I don't think he's that compelling to watch. Especially in comparison to... There are actors in this movie that I normally don't gravitate towards, but I think are really good here. I find he somewhat stands out.
You don't think he's the greatest WCW champion, huh? No, that's
for me. He was better than Vince Russo.
That's for a discussion for another day.
Because at least David Arquette had a whole promo about I don't deserve the title. And they, you know, I mean, I think Arquette winning the belt was better than Vince McMahon putting the belt on himself as a fucking babyface.
Adam, how do you feel about David Arquette here, sir?
I think he's fine. I think he could have been a little more of the straight man. I think that's what's needed here for this role. I literally get that John Saxton type for this, you know, but younger. Maybe somebody who, like, I got to assume that Dewey went to the school, but I don't think it calls that out specifically, but you can make that attachment there, and it, like, he's fine. I think it may be the best thing he's done that's not Ready to Rumble. Jesus. But, yeah, you know, future WCW champion right there, and, This is where it begins.
Where it begins. Craven's using a ton of establishing shots as we move to Sydney, sitting with Billy, Tatum, and the rest of her friends, which include Jamie Kennedy's Randy Meeks and Matthew Lillard's Stu Mocker. Randy, of course...
Schumacher.
Randy, of course, knows all the ways people die in each movie, so he's an automatic suspect. And Sydney is told how to gut somebody, and Stu is revealed to have dated Casey Becker until her boyfriend started dating her. So we're getting a little backstory here. Matthew Lillard, Jamie Kennedy, they are two very polarizing people in this series. I gotta say, I like them both. I like the dynamic they have. Matthew Lillard just has an incredibly interesting face, and he uses it to its biggest ability in this film. And I also like he has some good acting talent too. I liked him a lot in The Descendants. I thought he was very fun in that, and I like him in this. I think him and Jamie Kennedy are good in this movie. Matt, how do you feel about those two?
Well, I like that you have the nerd and the jester as archetypes that are two separate characters.
Yes,
would have been very easy to just make these two one character. But I feel like they did that because, okay, if Randy was the co-killer, it would have made no sense.
Very good point.
And look, I have no love for Jamie Kennedy whatsoever because I saw Son of the Mask.
Oy vey. And
what a disaster of a performance. Like, this guy thought he was going to be Jim Carrey. Like, are you out of your mind?
To be fair, that was a disaster of a film.
It was too, but ironically, speaking of Jim Carrey, Matthew Lillard kind of has that dynamic with his facial expressions. Mm-hmm. I mean, if they made a Jim Carrey biopic... Be pretty yep. close.
Adam,
especially if you saw like Five Nights at Freddy's recently. He's kind of hamming it up there in a good way.
Adam, how do you feel about these two, sir?
I think they both do a pretty good job. I think Jamie Kennedy brings that, let's just say, Garrett sensibility to this film in his role.
Down to the point where he was working at the video store at the same time I was working at a goddamn video store.
Yes. You know, and future star of Wing Commander, Matthew Lillard. Just, it's, again, you know, I'm watching this with my daughter, and she's like, I can't remember the character's name, but she calls him out from Five Nights at Freddy's.
Oh, nice. So
that's where she's actually got that connection. So by the end of it, she's like, he does the same moves. He does. So it's nice that he's been able to keep this back. But this is a character that turns goofy. And I think sometimes the way the character is written, I think butts up against Dewey a little bit, because I think they try to split that comedy between two similar characters. But I like Matthew Lillard. And I think if you look at him and you look at Skeet Ulrich playing Billy, they're the two sides of that coin.
Well, the weird thing, you know, you talk about Matthew Lillard, what your daughter knows him from versus you guys. I'm in the middle because he was Shaggy.
Oh, yeah.
And he's still playing him 20 years later. I know,
still playing him to this day.
But he loves doing it. And, you know, God bless him when you find work that you
exactly
don't. But I was going to mention, him and Freddie Prinze Jr., were they fucking? Because she's all that. She's all that. They're both in it.
Yeah,
Scooby-Doo, they're both in Scooby-Doo.
Mm-hmm.
And the rumor was, if Freddie Prinze Jr. was in Punisher Warzone, Matthew Lillard was going to play Looney Bin Jim.
That was the rumor.
Wow.
She's all that is obviously one that I knew him from as well. One thing this scene establishes, guys, now this is something that was in a few of the slashers from back in the 80s, but it wasn't the type of slashers I watched. Like, I watched the ones with Jason. I watched the ones with Freddy. I watched the ones with, like, the supernatural zombie type killers. This establishes that we're not in a typical slasher setting. What I mean is, the Friday the 13th or Texas Chainsaw or Halloween, you had other entities, right? Other things who are or used to be men. Here, with all the talk of what each did and didn't reveal in their interviews with police, they are establishing that this isn't going to be that type of film. It's a whodunit. And I rebelled against that when I initially saw this. And you can go to Adam to this. I was kind of pretty vocal about this. I didn't like the fact that we are not an actual horror film. We're in a whodunit. At that time, I'll talk about how I feel now. But Adam, did you brush up against that as well?
I didn't at the time, because they were creating a new monster, quote unquote, with the Ghostface Killer. God, even that's hard to say with Ghostface Killer. Being a fucking rapper. God damn, this thing has been, it's tough. They really should have locked down more trademarks on this film. Yeah. Come on, Weinstein. But now later on, yeah, I could absolutely see that. But at the time, creating this type of new character in an era where you had Freddy, you had Jason, you had Michael Myers, you had Pinhead, and you had, what, Leatherface. And then you had 20 years of not really anything. So I think it was innovative, but I do get your point that you don't have this supernatural being. You just have Billy.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And they were all singular entities. You know, it was the same killer every movie.
Yeah.
And this was how they differentiated it. And that's what I like about this series the most. I like the going into every movie knowing it's a different killer and trying to deduce it. Because you can also judge these movies based on how well you think they handle that aspect.
I'm looking forward to looking at these three movies I haven't seen to try to play that game. Because, again, I haven't seen them yet. So that's going to be a fun game to play for a bit. So Sydney takes off after the liver alone joke that Stu tells, which I thought was actually kind of funny. And she's dropped off at home by the bus as Tatum says that she'll stay over. Sydney goes to her closet as the music kind of amps up. She turns on the TV to see a lot of stuff about the Woodsboro double murder. And this is also when we learn that Sydney's mom was murdered the year before. Matt, this is the melodrama you were talking about, right?
Yes, and it's the certain family members being off in slasher films.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, Halloween, you have the sister being killed. Sometimes the parents are not even in the picture. I found this interesting. You had a mom who was brutally murdered, not just... And, like, that is a media frenzy in the same way that's echoing with what's happening in the here and now of the movie.
We see the sun go down as Sydney is woken up by the phone, and it's Tatum, who says that she's on her way to the video store before stopping by. The phone rings again, and it is who we've heard before, and Sydney says that it's Randy. She's thinking it's Randy, so she goes over how insulting horror films are, and this is when the caller reveals that he's actually not Randy. He says the question isn't who he is, it's where he is, which is the front porch. She walks out and doesn't see anything, asking where he is. He says right here as she tries picking her nose to call this bluff. She's then told that if she hangs up, she'll die like her mother. And this freaks her out, so she says, fuck you, and hangs up and locks the door, only to see that Ghostface is actually in the house. She then does exactly what she said she was insulted by, as the killer comes in and she tries dialing 911 on her computer. Adam, remember this? You dialed 911 on your computer?
Yes, because this was the big thing, that yes. If somebody was trying to use the phone and you were online, you had a big problem. So you could, it was like a requirement by the FCC or FCC, like that it was mandated legally. They had to rush this into effect.
Yeah, and by the way, caller IDs tripled after this movie was out because parents were so freaked out by it. Another thing that this shows too is this isn't exactly the most graceful of killers. As Matt, he gets beat the shit in this movie, doesn't he?
Yeah, well, that's also the thing when you realize, oh, these are high school kids.
Yeah.
So, of course, they're going to be clumsy. And, I mean, Lillard's certainly much more imposing than Skeet Ulrich by default. But I like that just because they're, you know, you're not dealing with the supernatural or a hulking behemoth like Jason, you can have fun with the killer, but you can also still be intimidated by them with the psychological aspect. So you can have it both ways, but I cannot watch the scene without seeing her type white woman in trouble from Scary Movie, which is one of my favorite jokes in that entire film, because of course that would cause the cops to come running.
I watched that movie one time because you and our other co-hosts were so on me to watch it. And I haven't watched it since. Like, it was okay, but I don't want it to ruin the horror that I love so much. The killer then leaves as Billy shows up, but as he comforts her, oh my God, Adam, a fucking cellular phone falls out of his pocket. So she freaks out again and walks outside, only to see Dewey with a ghost face mask as police arrest Billy. Adam, it was not as commonplace to have a cell phone on you at this time, was it?
No, I think it's Billy and Zach Morris were the only people that had a freaking cell phone. Yeah, this is weird, though, because you have a big, like, scary moment, like a drama moment, and then it gets a little goofy, like, right off the bat. And I do think that these parts of it are not done great. I think it's got a hard time deciding what tone the entire middle part of this movie wants to be.
Well, Matt, this is the red herring you called out earlier, right?
One of several. Like, the one movie always always sets you up to think, oh, there's no way Billy's the killer. Or they're making it so obvious that there's no way it could be him.
Mm-hmm.
And they do the Obi-Wan thing where it's from a certain point of view. Because the reveal is, he's not the killer, he's a killer.
Mm-hmm.
You could retitle this series and you could have it be Scream : The Red Herring Saga.
Yeah, I mean, literally, one of the jokes, speaking of Matthew Lillard, the pup named Scooby-Doo show, there is a character named Red Herring.
Is there really?
That they always think, and they call it out, they think, it's literally a ginger kid.
Oh, that's funny.
That's like a bully. It's a joke that's too clever for that show, because it goes over kids' heads, but that's kind of what this series is also. Certain films play much more with false pretense about and assumptions about who the killers are, that here it's, you know, it's a very fun mystery. It's so purposeful that you think it's, you know, there's no way, and then it actually is. This is also echoing the scene in Nightmare on Elm Street where they arrest Rod after Tina gets killed.
Uh-huh. Good call.
It's almost at the exact same point structurally.
This is when Tatum pulls up, and we learn that Tatum is actually Dewey's sister, so we have a connection here. Dewey gives the mask to the chief as they pull out, and then Gail pulls up. Gail is trying to get Sydney to talk, but she gets away from her, and Gail yells at her cameraman for being fat and slow. Again, Courtney Cox is being the complete bitch. And I hate saying that because my mom's name is Gail, so I hate associating that name with this character. But
yeah, welcome to my fucking world. You know how many douchebag Matts are in the movie?
Good point. Dewey is comforting Sydney as Billy and his dad are interrogated about his cell phone. The sheriff asks about Casey, and the sheriff says that he has to hold Billy until he can get his phone record. Gail shows up to the police station as Billy is led past Sydney. Dewey says that there's no way that they can trace the Ghostface costume, but the sheriff is doubting whether Billy did it. Tatum then drags Dewey out, and more frantic camera work as Gail approaches Sydney again. Tatum tries leading her away as Sydney asks about Gail's book before punching her out. Jesus Christ.
I can't think of this. Like, I immediately go to Die Hard.
Yeah,
like, there's exactly not enough people knocking out fucking reporters like this.
Why wasn't this William Atherton? Dewey brings Sydney some ice as Tatum asks if she thinks Billy really did it. Sydney gets another phone call as the killer calls and says that they got the wrong guy. He then promises that she'll find out who he is soon enough, and we're hearing that Sydney was the lead witness in the Cotton Weary case and that Billy was released. So here's our one shot of Liev Schreiber here.
It's crazy. Like, I remember Liev Schreiber, and I'm assuming that's from next week, but I could not believe that all we get is a really quick shot of him here on the TV, and he's credited in this and everything. Like it's just funny because I'm like, oh yeah, I remember Jude Law on this, and clearly I have Gattaca issues.
Yes, you do. Starting with the fact that you like that film.
Dewey. Oh, blame you.
Dewey drops it off to Linda Blair waving a mic in her face as she goes right to Gale. Funny to have Linda Blair here, but she was in one of Craven's first movies, so he decided to just kind of throw her a bone here.
She should have been holding a basketball.
She tells Gale that she's not there to fight and that she owes her mother. But as Gale talks to Sydney, Sydney starts feeling different, and Gale calls her out on it, and doubt is raised on whether Cotton was framed.
Well, that's also the whole thing of, like, he might as well have a scene where he's putting on a glove.
Exactly.
In the courtroom.
Yeah, that was huge at this time. We were, like, a year removed from that, so year and a half.
Yeah, like it was as pop, like, it was the Monday Night Wars for suburban families.
Oh my God, yeah. Me and my mom watched it every day. Tatum pulls Sydney away, and Gale wants proof to not save Cotton's life, but to raise her book sales. Oh, I love Courtney Cox in this. I didn't realize how much I did until I watched it for this podcast. Sydney gets pranked by someone running through the halls in a scream mask as she runs into a still white-shirted Billy. Billy says it wasn't him as he was in jail. He also calls out that he has a girlfriend who would rather call him psycho than touch him, and that it was time to get over the death of her mom from a year ago. Kids, this is not your way to get in your girlfriend's pants. I got news for you.
No, it's really not.
Sydney apologizes for what her traumatized life has done to his own and then leaves. We cut to Principal Hembree, a.k.a. Fonzie, suspending the two kids for what they did by running through the halls, and Craven is showing him rise the shears as if he were a suspect. We are getting everybody as a suspect here. At one point, we even have the police chief stomping out his cigarette, which is the exact same boots that Ghostface wears later on in the bathroom. So we are putting everybody front and center here as a suspect.
Well, the movie calls it out. You literally have Randy say everybody's a suspect.
Yep. We cut to Sydney overhearing two girls talking about her mom in the girls' restroom as Ricky Lake is brought up, and then the girls leave. God, this movie is so fucking 90s.
that's the one that made me just timestamp.
Yeah, same here. For the most part, I think this holds up pretty well, but the whole cellular phone and Ricky Lake thing, yeah, that stamps it. Sydney then turns around and looks under the doors in the stalls as she hears her name uttered. She asks who's there and checks under the stalls again, only to see boots fall, and she slides past him before leaving. We get another news report as Gale runs down Dewey. Dewey says everything is in control as Gale starts flirting and hitting on him. And of course, this was the beginning of their pretty big romance, which I think they got a kid out of, and they were in a few more of these movies together, and they called it quits.
Yeah, and their relationship in the movies echoed their real life.
Yes.
Their real life stages.
So Hembree gets on the loudspeaker and says that all classes are suspended as Dewey clears up what a serial killer is and even tells her that he hasn't ruled out Sydney's father as a suspect. He also says
that... Which is also kind of... I was thinking of Freddy versus Jason with the mom that died.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Stu and Sydney leave with Sid as Stu says that there's a party at his house tonight. Tatum convinces Sid to go with her. Meanwhile, the Fonz is trying on a mask and fixing his hair, Fonzie style. Nice little touch there, as there's a knock on his door. He can't see anyone other than a familiar-looking janitor wearing a familiar sweater. Matt, how'd you feel about this Wes Craven cameo?
That felt like a holdover if Tarantino directed this.
I like that he's wearing the exact same sweater, though. That is the exact same sweater from the first Nightmare on Elm Street film.
This is when so much of this, like, 30, 45 minutes feels like it's nothing but in here to film a trailer for. Every tease of who could be the killer, every callback to horror franchises, this is the trailer, is this entire kind of section of the film. And I got to say, I don't care for it.
Really?
Other than Fozzie being here, you know, because I do think that he does a pretty good job. And I had to look because I assumed maybe he was a producer because Winkler is involved in so many things that you don't really think of. Like, he is responsible for a lot of stuff coming to fruition. No, he wasn't. But I don't know. So I think the beginning is amazing. And I think this entire second act gets really confused as to what it wants to be.
I've seen Winkler talk at cons about this movie, and he said that it was literally a last minute thing. He didn't want to do it. His agent convinced him to do it. He's like, I don't want to be in like this little slasher film. What are they going to need me for? And I like him in this. I think he's a fun presence every time he's on. I love when he's messing with these kids after the prank. You know, it's fun stuff.
I think he's fun. I think he brings a good level to this. I think you get some highs and lows. I think you get a lot of inconsistencies. I think he's bringing the right tone.
Well, I appreciate that they got someone in a movie that's playing with tropes really against type for this material. It would have been too much wink wink if they got like John Carpenter or even Robert Englund to play that role.
What do you think about Wes Carpenter? You think Wes Carpenter could have done it? As we hear here in a bit. So Hembree opens the closet to no one being there. So he closes it again, and he's stabbed to death as Craven gets a close-up on his eye. Now, this kill was Bob Weinstein's idea because he had called up Craven and Williamson and said, you know what, there's 30 pages where nothing happens, kind of like what Adam just said, and we need a kill. So they kill this principal, but it also serves another purpose because this is what gets the most of the crowd out before all the happenings at the party go on.
You get two things here. One, you eliminate somebody who they just teased as a suspect, at least for those that are under the age of 15. And then it completely shifts this movie because we're done with the school. It's party time.
Sydney goes over rumors of the affair between Cotton and her mom with Tatum. As Tatum brings up, how many times can you hear the story about Richard Gere and gerbils before you start believing it? Which Williamson said on the commentary, he got in a lot of trouble for that line.
Yeah, I'm sure Richard Gere's lawyer was at the top of that list. I mean, that rumor was so bad, even Family Guy made fun of it with him doing an Easter egg hunt and him thinking it was up his ass.
And then Tatum tells Sid to stop as she's starting to sound like some Wes Carpenter film or something. We then cut to a very famous scene of this film, the scene inside the video store as Randy points someone towards the Howling and Stu defends Billy for standing in the horror section. I love that. Where they're like, if you were accused of killing somebody, would you be in the horror section of a video store? And this is when Randy starts calling out horror cliches by saying that the killer always kills the girlfriend. And Randy even asks if Sydney would go with him. Randy also gives a theory about Sid's dad. Also, this proves that he's just a red herring. So, Adam, very famous scene here, right?
It is. And I love this part. As we shift here and we get towards the third act, like this is when I start having some fun. And this to me is a little more what it should be because I think it loses some of the writing previously, but it takes itself fun. It doesn't make funny, you know, to quote a different film. So I like the way that it does this. And it also takes like 2 minutes to establish some rules and some stuff that we may have forgotten and just give some, I don't know, respect or thumbs up or just, you know, kind of a head nod to those that came before it.
Yeah. This is almost like the church for moviegoers. Because he's talking to a bunch of people who are like unfamiliar or don't think about that stuff the way film enthusiasts do. Mm-hmm.
This is the type of scene when you're a Garrett or an Adam and you're into these movies, but you're taking someone to see this movie who isn't. This is when you're like, see, I was right. Yep. See, I was right. See.
Mm-hmm. Billy says that maybe Randy is the killer, and Randy says that this is Millennium. Motives are modus operandi.
Which means we have a hard time writing the script.
Exactly. We see a montage of the curfew in effect as Sid says that this town looks like the town that dreaded sundown. By the way, great films, both the original and remake. That was my commentary, by the way. Sid mentions that she shudders to think who would play her in a movie version of her story. While Dewey thinks that she is the Meg Ryan type, Sid says with her luck, she'd get Tori Spelling. Stay tuned next week. The girls go into the supermarket as they talk about Sid's intimacy issues, and Tatum says that Billy and his penis just don't deserve her. Dewey has an ice cream cone outside the station, and of course, Craven is having this chief wear the same boots that Sid saw in the bathroom earlier, so Craven is not leaving a stone unturned when it comes to suspects. We then cut to the beginning of the 42-minute finale in this house, boys, or scene 118, as it would come to know by. This set of scenes were a nightmare to shoot. Craven was getting notes from the studio that nothing here looked scary, and once again, his job came to be in jeopardy, because he actually almost lost his job at the beginning of this shoot, because the Weinsteins wanted him to shoot in Vancouver, but Craven insisted on staying in California, staying in L.A. if you tell producers that you're not going to save them money, guess what? They're going to want to fire you. But they kept him on. And this final scene also had his job in jeopardy. But Daly told the Weinsteins to keep him on and trust their director.
And an important thing to note is that it's the poltergeist dynamic of setting horror in suburbia, which is not routinely scary unless you look at modern mortgage payments. But the part of the appeal of horror is artificially creating scares in an environment that is normally one of comfort and complacency. So this was 100% the right call to set the climax or a third of the movie in one location. I mean, there's some interplay because like Gail gets reincorporated, but all in all, it takes the opening of the first one and just the opening and magnifies it tenfold almost.
We see Gail able to convince Dewey to tag along on his investigation into the party as Adam's favorite band Republica is playing and the party talk about Jamie Lee Curtis in Halloween. Dewey shows up with Gail, which Tatum takes issue with, and Dewey tells Sid that they haven't found her father yet. We see Tatum go out to the garage, apparently very cold.
Yeah, this is like Katie Holmes at the end of Batman Begins.
I'm telling you. She gets some beers as the door closes, and a cat runs through the bottom door. And as we all know, cats are assholes, so of course we're going to see Tatum die for paying attention to it. She can't get back in, even after knocking, so she raises the garage door, but the door is closed by someone in a Ghostface costume. She thinks it's Randy and begs to be the helpless victim, but Ghostface pulls out a knife and cuts her arm as he once again takes a beating when she fights back, but she can't make it through the door as she's raised right to her death.
Okay, I want to thank Rose for bringing up the greatest meme ever when I see every how excited are you for Halloween? This excited? Because you put your eye out, kid. This is the strongest garage door opener that has ever been invented. I mean, I know she probably weighs nothing but $1.10, but that's not how garage doors work. And I still don't know how she died being in the cat door, but I do like it's claustrophobic in the garage. You know, she's throwing bottles. She's fighting back. She's not just a, you know, helpless damsel, but it was time for a kill. I think I like this one as, you know, it's not up there for the that we got at the beginning of the film, but we needed this. We need to understand that now this is a haunted house that we have going on here with this ghost face showing up. So it serves its purpose and it really starts to ramp up the tension. This is a good scene.
She had to be nailed to this door to actually be able to stick to it as it was raised.
And raising, boom.
Craven's so funny on the commentary because he says many 16-year-old boys have thanked him for this scene. Matt, how do you feel? Matt, how do you feel about this?
I'm going to say it. I guess you could say there was a lot of craft put into that door when it was constructed.
Jesus Christ. Sid calls for Tatum as Billy shows up to talk to Sid alone. Sidney pulls him upstairs as Randy asks what Leatherface was doing here. And we get some Clueless references as if, oh, really, Alicia? We're throwing everything at the wall here, boys. We see Gail looking at the camera she mounted in the party as Sid and Billy talk. They both apologize to one another, and wouldn't you know it, Billy gets her clothes off and he gets laid. Little moment by Ulrich here as he glances over her shoulder because in his mind he was waiting for Stu to make his grand entrance. So that was a little ad lib done by Skeet Ulrich there. What I like about this is it sets up that Sid's no longer the virgin, so she's likely to be killed too.
Yeah, it's like her force shield, her shield generator was broken.
Yes.
Which, I guess it's a euphemism too, given what happens.
Yeah, it completely takes away that virgin plot armor. I got to say, though, I can't stand these two together. I think they got some horrible chemistry throughout the film, and I think this just amplifies that when they try to make this what it is. This is UPN, which predates the CW, would say, let's do another take. Ah, man, these two are cringy together.
My endorsement of that sentence, the way to fix that is if that was her ex-boyfriend and he was trying to get back together with her.
That's a good fix. What I do like about this is Billy and Stu are screenwriters, right? They are making their own movie. So Billy doing this is actually making what they want to make happen. I don't really think about the chemistry between these two, honestly. I'm just seeing it through horror tropes, because how many times have we watched horror films of two people fucking and then Jason comes over and just kills them? And that's the only time we see them, you know?
Oh, yeah, no, from writing the movie that Stu and Billy are writing, it's perfect, because they should roll over in the bed and he should get a spear through the throat. Like, it's mm-hmm. step by step. I don't think these two act well against each other.
I like also that we're calling out that she's not Laurie Strode anymore, so she's a would-be victim. You know, Kevin Williamson did say his favorite movie of all time is Halloween. Later on, he would work on Halloween H2O. And
yeah, shit the bed.
Save it. And so I like the fact that they are calling that parallel out as well. Of course, this is what Randy lays out in the very next scene, the famous rule scene. We get Stu saying, "I'll be right back," and I actually laughed at that. The cameraman is bored as Dewey asks Gale to help him investigate the car, and he even asks her to walk with him. Before I get to that, Adam, how do you feel with the rules scene here?
Absolutely love it. This is fun. It's playful. And after the kill that we just had and after the setup of Sydney losing her virginity shield, this is just a great way to go into the finale.
Well, I like that we've had a movie that has had multiple direct references. You don't get much more literal than literally showing Halloween and him espousing upon it like a film professor would. A bunch of disinterested people who are only there because of the credits.
What I like about this scene with Dewey and Gale is that, to me, this meant that Dewey was the killer. I think back to this, and in my mind, when I first watched this in December of 1996, on a very cold, rainy day, a rainy night, I felt Dewey was the main suspect. He's too obviously not the killer, which to me meant that he was the killer.
I wasn't sure. I will say I was guessing up till the end.
So it's the Billy argument. It's too obvious. Just, yeah. I guess if you have a Y at the end of your name, it's obvious. Billy, Dewey, Randy.
Yeah.
That's three right there. But not there's Steve. Another world. If you were going to do the two killer reveal, it's Gale and her cameraman. That is also something that you could, I could see an alternate reality where that's the reveal.
Now, the next scene was something I used to hate. When I first saw this, I was like, oh my God. This whole thing of parallelism with the shots in both this and Halloween. When I watched this originally, I was like, God, this is so stupid. But when I watch it now, I love it. I love the fact that Craven and Williamson are using the music of Halloween to build this scene. I love the fact that Jamie Kennedy is telling Jamie Lee Curtis to turn around when he's the one who should turn around. This, I thought, was very fun stuff. And this is a nice little love letter from Williamson to John Carpenter, I felt.
Yeah, I think it's written well. I think it's shot even better. I like the POV that we get. I like the angles that Wes is using in these shots. Like it just really ramps up, because I got to say, for about an hour before this, I was like, I can't believe I don't like this film. And then we get here and I'm just like, oh, now I remember why I like it.
See, I never put together until this viewing that Jamie is actually Jamie Kennedy telling himself to turn around. Like, that did not ring true with me until just this viewing. And what I like about this too is Skeet Ulrich begged to have the costume on for this. So Craven let him wear the costume for this particular scene instead of the usual stuntmen that they had. So the phone rings and Randy answers it, and the other line says that they found the principal dead, so a lot of the gang leave to take a look, which of course causes the perfect distraction. Very dark humor here by Craven and Williamson.
Also a great way to eliminate way too many people that you have at this house. Mm-hmm. Like, you either need to have a bloodbath or you need to have a party scene elsewhere that everybody leaves for. Like, you always have that issue of how do you, it's the aliens problem, right? Okay, yep. We got way too many people. How do we get down to just a few? Really nice job. And yeah, definitely morbid. It's the type of thing that any high school kid would do. Yep.
It could have been the pool scene from Nightmare 2.
The cameraman slyly closes the van door, so we think that he might be a suspect now. Gale walks with Dewey as more flirting happens, and they're barely out of the way of speeding oncomers. Dewey apologizes as he's landed on top of Gale, and she points out that the car of Sydney's dad. So they head back. We go back to Billy and Sid as Billy asks if she's okay, and Sydney asks who he called with his one phone call when he was in jail. So this is a weird time to bring this up. He says that he called his dad, and she calls his lie as she says that she saw the sheriff call his dad. She swears she doesn't think he's the killer, as the killer appears behind Billy and supposedly kills him. Another red herring, right, Matt?
Literally, because there's blood.
Yep. Sydney then leaves the room and closes about six doors before landing at the upstairs window. She walks out of it and falls backwards onto a boat tarp. She looks up and sees Tatum's dead body, so this is that reveal. We cut to Sid pounding on the news van, and they see the Joker behind Randy, and as the cameraman notices there's a 30-second delay, he's taken out. Or so we think.
I like that delay.
Me too.
Because you think it's right there. It's just, yeah. But little pop, it's not needed, but it adds something.
So Sid gets out of the van and runs through a field. Meanwhile, Dewey tells Gale to call the sheriff for backup. Gale finds Kenny's blood as Dewey appears and Gale knocks him out. Love the visual of the blood on the windshield as Kenny is on the roof of the van. This is fun stuff. They use something like, what was it, Matt? Like 48 gallons or some crazy number of gallons of blood in this movie.
Yeah, it's insane how much fake blood they use in a movie that is, you wouldn't think had as much as it does.
Like, yeah.
You needed that much for a movie that, especially by comparison to contemporary things, pretty bloodless, all things considered, outside of a couple scenes.
I don't know, man. It's pretty bloody at points, but it just seems like overkill. Gale then drives the van right into a tree. Meanwhile, Sid is calling for Dewey, who is stabbed by Ghostface, and he appears. She goes into a car and is surrounded. She can't drive away because Ghostface has her keys. That was a nice reveal where he pulls them out and just kind of shakes them.
Well, yeah, that's also a great spin on, oh, the car won't start.
Yes. Sid then calls for help on the radio as Ghostface appears behind her and forces her out. She runs in the house as Stu and Randy appear and appeal their cases of not being the killer. Sid then says, fuck you both, and locks them out. She tells them to go away as Billy appears on top of the stairs and then rolls down. She asks how he's not dead, and apparently she can't smell the corn syrup as Randy comes in and says that Billy has gone mad. So here's the first
reveal. Especially because both corn syrup and ketchup give off very strong smells.
Very. Yeah, as somebody who's been on the set of quite a few independent horror films, there's no way to hide this smell. It gets all over the clothes. There's a reason why they mostly use CGI blood now.
I do think this is such an inside industry joke as much as anything else about just that corn syrup smell.
Mm-hmm. Billy then quotes Psycho and shoots Randy in the shoulder, and this is when Stu appears. We now know who's in on it, boys. They start their own game and then admit to framing Cotton Weary. They then say that they don't believe in motives because it's a lot scarier when there isn't a motive. Matt, how many times have we screamed that on this podcast? But the weird thing is he follows this with a damn motive of her mom fucking his dad. So which is it? Like, he can't decide. So they decide to not do it then. As Billy says, it's now the 1-year anniversary of them killing her mom. Matt, do you think this is too interconnected? Like, we talk about worlds being too close all the time on this podcast. Is this too interconnected?
I would say no, because they're overthinking it, and it's cliche written because they're trying to write the quote-unquote perfect script. So you want as much singularity and connective tissue as possible if that's your mentality. So I think in the context of how they're in their clearly misguided worldview are trying to frame this, no pun intended, I think it works. Especially because the way they explain it to like kind of make themselves the victim, you know, victimizing themselves, I think reinforces that their logic doesn't make a whole lick of sense.
I have a bigger issue with Sydney's father deciding on the 1-year anniversary of her mother's death that he's going to take off out of town on a freaking holiday. I mean, what a piece of shit dad, man, to leave your, I don't know. That bugs me still to this. Like, that's one of my first notes, that he's going to take off on this anniversary and leave his daughter alone. He's responsible for these two even having the opportunity. I get it. You know, it plays into that. And to me, it ties back into the nightmare thing, that the parents have a level of why this is all going on without being the killers themselves, that it's just tying something into it. I do think it's a little, God, it's not slut shaming because we don't know what's true and what's not, but it feels that way. And decades later, it feels a little cringy, but I do like that the reveal of them. I like the way that it's done. I like the way these two are playing off each other right here and what they're going to do to each other. I dig it. I dig it a lot. We did not see this kind of thing before.
No.
I hate that it's been done since, but I love it for the time.
Without giving too much away, I will say that this onion of her mom and what she's been doing gets peeled more and more as the sequels go on. So they pull out her dad and they're giving the scenario where they get away with it. So why give this away? Also, this whole stabbing each other just feels thrown in for comedic value.
It does. gotta. The one thing that I always remember is freaking Matthew Lillard and just his, I'm bleeding out here, man. My dad's gonna kill me. Like, it's just, he gives a performance that, like, in a movie that sometimes has got some really cringy shit, that one could be, it goes almost into Shaggy, but I like it still. You know, I do something about it.
Yeah. An ad lib by him, but it works.
Well, that's the whole thing of, you have to remember they're still teenagers.
Exactly.
And they can't, they don't understand the consequences. He's more upset about his parents being upset rather than him going to prison for life.
Exactly. Adam.
I mean, they're telling us they're teenagers. Mm-hmm. This is 90210 casting, but yeah.
They then fight over the knife, saying it's time to plan a sequel because these days every movie needs a sequel.
Boy, this series fucking ran with it.
I'm telling you.
That was meant to be a joke.
I
that
know.
Was literally meant to be a joke because this was deliberately done to not have a sequel.
30 years later, we're still playing that joke. Billy then says that movies don't create psychos. Movies make psychos more creative. Stu says the gun has disappeared and Gail appears with it. She gives her own scenario, which Sid agrees with, but Billy takes the gun away and kicks her into a post. Billy lays her across Dewey as Stu says that he's starting to really hurt from what they've done to one another. They then get a call saying that the police have been called. Stu says that he's cut too deep and is dying, and then he tells Sid that his excuse is peer pressure. I'm sorry, Matthew Lillard is fucking great in this. I don't care what anyone fucking says.
Well, that's also a great, like, commentary on peer pressure when it comes to, like, teenage drug use, which was still kind of a hot-button issue at the time.
Air commercials. Yep.
He then says, as we mentioned, that his mom and dad are going to be so mad at him. Meanwhile, Halloween is still playing as Sid runs out with an umbrella and stabs Billy. The umbrella was a little too much, I gotta say. I liked her coming out with the mask, but I didn't like the umbrella.
It's what would be in the closet.
Yeah,
it was either, that's, you know, true. If she did the hanger, it would be just too on the nose with Halloween playing. So true. What else is in there? I do feel really bad because I read this, and I read it years ago. I read it again. That poor fucking Skeet Ulrich has like a mesh covered, you know, covering on his chest because of surgery, and she stabbed him right in it.
Right in it, yeah. Craven mentions it on the commentary as well. He goes, he felt so bad about it. Stu then appears and has her pinned down as she bites him and then smashes a vase across his face before bringing the TV down on him. Very apropos there.
I can't believe that he did Nightmare 3.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't make that connection, but you're right.
She does everything but say, welcome to primetime, bitch.
She then grabs the mask as Randy appears and says he's never been more happy to be a virgin. Oh, this is great stuff. But Billy reappears and says hello to your mother as he prepares to kill Sydney. But there's Gail again to shoot him down. She then says I remember the safety that time, you bastard.
I hate that Gail shows up to shoot him here.
Why?
Why is Gail get the... I mean, the only thing I'm glad about is she doesn't get the final shot. But of all people who does not deserve to have a role in the killing of these two, it's Gail. Like, she's not a good person. She's as much as to blame for Sydney's problems as anybody else. That character does not deserve to have a role in the finale. It's because of who it is. It's just, I don't know. It always bugs me. There's no reason for her to show up here.
It feels like redemption to me, which is why it played okay for me.
Just wait till next week. She's not a redeemed character.
Matt, what do you think?
I'm sort of... Between the two of you, I'm more on Garrett's side. I think this works because it's the whole, you know, the last minute save is sort of a trope in and of itself when you think there's no way out. But here's my problem. The television killed him? Like, that was a fatal blow? Well, because...
It killed Jennifer in Nightmare 3.
Yeah, but that's because her head was smashed into it by a supernatural being.
I know.
And the fact that Matthew Lillard is in the cast for this new Scream movie...
He's in this one?
Well,
oh, damn, I didn't know that
either. I didn't.
So,
wow. Don't tell me anything, please.
Maybe
don't.
Not Stewart.
No, they haven't said his role. They've just said he's been cast in it.
For all we know, he's a voice.
As has the guy from Scream 3.
Okay. Well, we'll get to that when we get to it.
TVs were a lot bigger in 96.
Okay, well, they also weighed a lot more.
Yeah, that's true.
Yes.
Okay, so fine. But I'm like, that's it. Was kind of my question. That's my biggest complaint.
Gail, Sid, and Randy look at the carnage, and Randy warns that this is when the killer jumps up for one more big scare. Sid then shoots him and says, not in my movie, as they free her dad. We then cut to Gale giving another newscast in front of the house as the camera pans up and around, and Enigma plays, once again stamping this in the 90s, as credits roll on screen, and everyone even gets a Predator-type image in credit in during the credits, which I thought was funny. Scale of 1 to 10, what do we give Scream? Adam, my best friend of 30-plus years, sir, you go ahead and go.
We watch this movie now almost 20 years. God dang, 20 years, 30 years. Wow, I'm old. 30 years after its debut, it has aged better than a lot of 90s movies. A lot of them. But the problems that are inherent back then kind of get amplified today. With that, this is a meta movie, a meta commentary with a director who has only done it better with one other film. And we'll discuss that when we get into Nightmare. But this is as important to reinvigorating the horror genre as Jason Lives. And this thing really captivated a teenage audience. And I think that was part of the MPAA's issue, was a lot of horror movies were geared towards adults. Teenagers watched them. They watched them on video. They watched them at home. Teenagers were the victims in those movies. But the people that went to see those movies in theaters were adults. This one, it was for us. For a soundtrack and credit that looks like The Rage, Carrie 2, this movie delivers something that was kind of transcendent for the time. It brought it into, it made horror pop culture. It made it okay to like this type of stuff. It made it cool to talk to your friends about and have discussions about. And with that alone, this movie deserves its place in discussing just how important it is. The performances are kind of all over the board. I think Neve Campbell does a pretty dang good job. I think she is one of those really great final girls. But I love Heather Langenkamp, and I'm the one on this podcast that does.
Oh, my God.
Mute your mic. I think Skeet Ulrich is good at times, but I think he's more bad than good. I think Matthew Lillard, though, is pretty damn great throughout this entire thing. Courtney Cox and David Arquette are used too much in this film, where at the same time, Jamie Kennedy's not used enough. So it's all over the place. But when this movie is great, look at the opening 15 minutes. It is great. It is superb in its storytelling. The middle bogs this down, but the ending really redeems itself. This is a good movie. It's not a great movie. It's not a great written movie. It's not a great directed movie, but it is a good, solid movie that I think is a very good way to kick off any type of horror season or mood or just a discussion of film in general. So I'm giving it a 7, a very solid 7. I can't give it a 6 because it's too important and I have too much fun with it. But going back and watching it, the problems in this film kind of stand out pretty bad for me. But Drew Barrymore and the mood and the tone and Wes Craven's directing really sets this apart from so many other movies. So 7 on 10.
7 on 10 from the Heather Langenkamp loving Adam Bunch. Matthew, what do you say, sir?
Hang on, I have to clean up the blood from my lip because I had to clench it listening to Adam talk about the praise for New Nightmare. So now that my mouth is clear, and I can't wait for people to use that quote out of context, this movie is to the horror genre what X-Men and Spider-Man were to superheroes. We were coming out of a dark period, and not only did this movie, much like X-Men and Spider-Man, revitalize interest in the genre, it added prestige back to it. The mindset of, oh, this can be done well and can be looked at as legitimate cinema and not just genre fluff. Unfortunately, I haven't watched this since we did the retro, Garrett. So it's been damn near 5 years at this point. And I kind of feel similar to Adam, where I think a lot of this movie's importance has, if anything, been further accentuated with what's come after it, independent of the sequels. So its legacy has grown. But as a singular movie, which I'm trying to look at this as, independent of what it spawned and what it led to, I do think there are some flaws. I think that to Adam's point, some of the actors do better jobs than others. And I think it's one of those movies where it's got a killer opening, no pun intended, and a 40-minute conclusion that you can poke holes in, but is a marvel to behold as far as structure, as far as directing. You know, I think this is a big step up for Craven. It's one of his best directed movies, maybe his best directed movie in that regard. But I find the middle of this movie to be nowhere near as interesting. It feels like this movie is the reverse Oreo, where the cookies themselves are the most interesting part, and the cream I could do without. So, all in all, I enjoy it a lot. I think it's important, but I'd be lying to you if I said this was one of my favorite horror movies. I actually feel about this the way I feel about The First Nightmare on Elm Street, and my score is actually identical. It's a strong 7, but I can't bring myself to say I love it or put it in my, you know, upper echelon of horror films.
Wow, so we have 2 7s? Am I right on that?
Yeah.
2 7s.
Yes, sir.
Wow, okay. Here's the weird thing about this movie for me. It's funny that this movie just has had different effects on all of us. When I first watched this, I'm not going to say I didn't like it, but I did not understand why it was so popular and why people loved it so much. I didn't understand why people went and saw it as many times as they did. I didn't understand when I worked at a video store why so many people wanted to rent this goddamn movie, because I didn't think it was that good of a horror film. But as time has gone on and I have revisited it, Matt, just like you, I hadn't seen this since we did the original retro those years ago. I found myself more into it than I've ever been. And I'll say this, you know, after that opening scene, my score was already a 7. There is no movie that has a scene like that that does not deserve a high score already, because you have kicked this movie off with a scene that I want to go ahead and say this series will be chasing again. Have not seen the last 3, but I have a feeling that this series will be chasing the scene its entire time. And there's a reason for that. It's because the actress is good. Drew Barrymore is fantastic. And the directing is good. Everything works in that scene. And then the film kind of finds itself chasing itself. And that's where I'll agree with you guys on. I think the middle portion of this movie kind of drags. I think the Weinsteins were smart in telling Craven, you got to put some freaking kills here, because we have gone more than 30 minutes without one. So he kills Henry Winkler on screen. The reveal of the killers is, look, you have interconnected Sydney and her mother and these two, what we'll call psychos, at the end of this. And I think for what the movie is trying to be and what the story that the movie is trying to tell, I think it works. I love the fact that, you know, this movie was made out of desperation. Wes Craven, my God, he had just made Vampire in fucking Brooklyn. And people can praise New Nightmare all they want after the fact, but the fact of the matter is, when that movie was out, it didn't make a dime. This is Craven making that movie and making it better. And everybody flocked to it. Everybody wanted to see more of it. And I will be the opposite of Tarantino and say that I love Craven's directing in this. Even in the boring parts, he finds things like the sheriff's shoes to keep us interested. So yeah, my opinion of this movie has definitely grown, but there is that middle portion that drags it down. The end kind of picks it up a bit, but after that opening scene, which was a 7, it gets one more point for me, which is an 8. So I want to give Scream 1996 an 8 on 10. What it did for the horror genre cannot be overstated. This movie's effect was in full effect in the years to come, and we're going to talk about future sequels and what happened as a result. But for this one movie, I think everything kind of gelled together, and the fact that Craven was as desperate as he was, Williamson was damn near homeless because he was like 3 months behind on his rent. Drew Barrymore's career was in trouble. Everybody's career was in trouble with the exception of the TV actors here. And I love the fact that everything came together for this one movie. So 8 on 10 for Scream 1996. Will I go as high as an 8 or even higher as the series goes on? I do remember next week having diminished returns as far as how much I liked it at the time we reviewed it 5 years ago. Matt, what are you expecting next week when we talk about 1997's Scream 2?
Well, I don't remember having the best time with this movie in comparison to the first one back when we did this series initially. But I've seen with some of these retros, we've taken a second stab at, no pun intended.
Nice.
Although fully intended in this sense, given how Scream 2 opens. I'm curious to see if my opinion has evolved, because I'm also curious to see how do I feel about the sequels now that we've had a new set of sequels that are different than what Craven did. So I will have sort of that in my mind as a new perspective going into this for... I could count on one hand probably the amount of times I've seen all the Scream sequels. In fact, 5 and 6 I've only seen once a piece. So my opinion is there to be changed if this tickles my fancy.
All right, Adam, as somebody who saw it once and saw it one time when it was originally released, what are you expecting when we get to Scream 2 next week?
I expect to at least remember more of the film. Like, I have one vision, and that's, I think it's Liev Schreiber's, like, standing on a stage with his mom. Like, I remember nothing about this film. I don't know who else is in it. I don't know, like, what happens. I assume there's some kills. Like, it is amazing. Like, look, I know I got some holes in my mind from the 90s, but God dang, I can't remember how little I remember about this film. As Matt said, there's times where we go back to things and we're like, you know what? And kind of have that type of mindset. So we'll see if this one does it. I don't know. Like, this might as well be a Jaws 2 first watch for me with the little that I know about this film. So with that in mind, I'm kind of looking forward to it. But my expectations, not very high. I mean, come on. It's a 1 year later, late 90s sequel to Scream. So maybe my low expectations will help out.
I love Adam's deductive reasoning. It's so brilliant. We're getting ready to watch a slasher film, and he goes, I'm going to assume there are kills in this movie.
That on the poster. Thanks, Ebert.
And again, I haven't seen this next film since the last time me and Matt reviewed it. So I'll be interested to revisit it and see if I have a more positive feeling on it. But until next week.
For the record, before you conclude,
yes,
you can tell Adam has no memory because he mistaked Liev Schreiber
for Viola. You know what? I wasn't going to call it out, but I'm glad you did.
Shit.
I was not going to call it out. Oh, but if we didn't call it out, one of our listeners definitely would have, Mr. Roy Schneider. But until next week, when we get to Scream 2, no, please don't kill me, Mr. Ghostface. I want to be on the podcast. Thank you, boys.
The past will come back to bite you in the ass. Whatever you think you know about the past, forget it. The past is not at rest. Any sins you think were committed in the past are about to break out and destroy you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Wow. That was intense.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Watch a few movies, take a few notes. It was fun.
But us, we're gonna carry on and plan the sequel, because let's face it, baby, these days, you gotta have a sequel.
If you like this retrospective review, check out our archives at percolatedmedia.net, as we have tons of franchise reviews such as the Alien film series, the Pirates of the Caribbean film series, the Exorcist films, the Jaws franchise, the Predator films, the film adaptations of author Stephen King, the John Wick franchise, the Jurassic Park and Jurassic World film series, the Beetlejuice films, the Megan films, and so much more.
The reason I'm here is to help you.
Scream Retrospective Introduction, performed by Adam and Sarai, directed by Garrett. Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett and Matt.
It could be fucking Reservoir Dogs by the time this thing is through.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
By definition alone, they're inferior films.
It's bullshit generalization. Many sequels have surpassed their original.
Oh, yeah?
Name one.
Yeah.
Aliens. Far better than the first.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, there's no accounting for taste.
Thank you, Ridley Scott rules.
Scheduling done by Matt.
What did you just say?
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
This is all because of you.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is an independently produced podcast, and it's thanks to the support of listeners like you that help keep it that way. Please like and subscribe, as well as leave a review on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
So how can I help you? Or do you want me to tell you who you look like?
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
Now welcome to the final act.
This podcast is a Percolated Media production. Copyright 2026, and any and all music, movie, and sound clips are used for entertainment purposes and review only.
Now, Sid, don't you blame the movies! Movies don't create psychos! Movies make psychos more creative!
So, in closing, let me say good luck, Godspeed, and for some of you, I'll see you soon.
Backup is going.
Recording, backup. Garrett, you recording?
Let's. Yeah. Yes, I have my recorder going. Wow, Adam, you do stuff on this podcast. I'm proud of you for that.
Do.
I love you. But you also have everything revolving around. God damn, what's the name of that actress that got kicked off this last one?
Oh, Melissa, is it Barrera?
Yeah. Melissa Barrera, she's Michelle Barrera, whatever her name is. Melissa Barrera, she is...
And then Williamson came on to direct. So I'm very curious to talk about it, to see this new one. Because it has Trainwreck written all over it, just based on everything that's happened.
You know, I had no idea that Christopher Landon was Michael Landon's son. No idea. I just found that out, and I listened to an interview with him this last week.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Hallway to Heaven. Adam, what do you think, sir? Do you think... All right. Unless anyone has anything else to add, I want to go ahead and get into the plot. Adam, anything to add?
You like scary movies?
All right. So we.
Oh, there was one other. There was one other name I wanted to. I found interesting in the director names.
Go ahead.
Because he's Tarantino's buddy, Robert Rodriguez.
Oh yeah, Rodriguez vouched for this as well. He ended up getting the faculty, which by the way, I've never seen.
Williamson. Yeah, he got his Williamson script.
Oh, is that a Williamson script as well?
Yeah, that rip off of The Thing. Yep. Mm.
Wow. How have you not seen this? You, I'm curious. Like, watch you and Jen watch The Faculty and tell us what you think.
I probably will do that. You know what? You know what I got her into? You guys are gonna laugh your ass off. I don't know how. Me and her have started watching Eli Roth's History of Horror.
I enjoy those quite a bit.
Oh my god, they're so fucking good. And she looks at it and she's like, "Movies aren't scary anymore." I'm like, "Well, yeah." She's finding it very interesting. All right.
Yeah. Turn on your local news.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, she watches enough true crime, for Christ's sake.
For you to give Eli Roth a compliment means it's really good.
Yeah, exactly. Same here. That piece.
Yeah, and that's why I was so disappointed, not to go on this tangent, although this movie is full of tangents. Yeah. Eli Roth's History of Horror made me disappointed all the more with the James Cameron History of Science Fiction.
Yeah.
That one's very surface level. And it's all like stuff that we've heard regurgitate, like when he talks to George Lucas about, yep. Oh yeah, I based Return of the Jedi on the Viet Cong, and it's all stuff we've heard before.
Whereas mm-hmm. History of Horror, they go into, you know, your big heavy hitters, but they'll talk about some really obscure movies that not enough people champion, and they interview more interesting people.
Well, not only that, they also get into what was going on in the world at the time, too, which she really likes seeing.
Yeah, and that, as we'll talk about, has major bearings on certain aspects of Scream.
Definitely, yeah. All right.
So I do have a spoiler question. Well, that also makes sense because she's easily the biggest name.
Correct. At this point. Absolutely.
Because what was Friends on at this point?
Oh, yeah. Friends was a few seasons in. I don't think Party of Five was on yet. Was it, Adam?
You would know better than me at that
point. I can't remember. I think it was.
That's why you need to watch the Faculty, Mr. Gilmore Girls. But no, if anything, yeah. Like, I know Courtney Cox.
That's also subversion because, to your point, the parents were an afterthought in these movies. And when they were, they gave horrendous performances like the mom in Nightmare on Elm Street. And here, not only do the parents feel like actual characters, they're integral to the modus operandi of the killers. At least one of them. Like, that's never a correlation that's made in these movies. In Freddy's case, it was, but not with the teenagers, necessarily.
Renee Blakely's a friend of mine. But she's so bad in that movie.
Oh my god, her acting in the when they're in the basement and she's explaining, and it's even worse if you've ever seen the deleted footage where so a lot of people don't know this because we're talking about tangents and it's Wes Craven related. In the original Nightmare on Elm Street script, they were going to reveal that all the teen characters like Rod and Johnny Depp and Nancy all had older siblings
mm-hmm.
that Freddy killed,
mm-hmm.
which I'm kind of glad they cut that because it just would have made it all the more convoluted.
Yeah. The fact that Blakely was in Nashville and then she turns into performers like that, just, it blows my mind.
She's also like the most oblivious mom on the planet. She can't smell brewing coffee in the fucking, in her bedroom. Like, how many coffee pots does this family own?
Matt, when we get to that series, we can dissect that, sir. We then cut to... Matt, if you want to set the Patreon on fire, put Spice Girls on that list of movies to review, and you will hear...
I'm a gay man, and I have no interest in that.
So. You will have a huge fight over which is the best Spice Girl. That's all I'll say.
Saw that movie in the movie theater.
Yes, I did too. And we fought about who was the hottest Spice Girl.
Ginger.
Well, always. I would just be on mute at that whole discussion. I'd be the moderator. don't ask me to give a tie-breaking vote because I wouldn't give you a literally straight.
Tatum.
But I also like that she's not afraid to. Yes, and it's the certain family members being offed in slasher films.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, Halloween, you have the sister being killed. Sometimes the parents are not even in the picture. I'm on 2 hours of sleep, so my brain's going 100 miles an hour. I literally have my own Nancy pot of coffee sitting on my desk with me. But yeah, I
and they called it quits.
Yeah, and their relationship in the movies echoed their real life.
Yes.
Their real life stages.
Yes. Sorry, I unplugged my mic there for a second. So, Hembree gets... He also says something that I think Adam agrees with, that Gail looks better in person. Never mind. I guess you're not a Courtney Cox fan, huh, Adam?
This is... Like, her flirting with Dewey would, like, I'm that moment in Bugs Bunny where the ears melt. I'm like, this is me in the 90s and 2000s and 2010s. And yeah. There's two reasons I watched the remake of The Longest Yard, and it's not Adam Sandler.
What are those reasons?
Go ahead, Adam.
Oh, her post-baby enhancements?
There you go.
She's in that?
Yeah, she is.
Yeah, she plays his girlfriend at the very beginning of the movie.
Stu and Sydney leave with...
second act gets really confused as to what it wants to be.
You know, Henry Winkler and Tom Hanks hate each other.
A lot of people hate Tom Hanks.
I just want to say,
a lot of people hate Tom Hanks.
I was shocked when I read that. I've seen Winkler talk at
I think it works, especially because they, the way they explain it, to like kind of make themselves the victim, you know, victimizing themselves, I think reinforces that their logic doesn't make a whole lick of sense.
If you want a modern day version of this, listen to the Allison Mack interview on Inside of You that happened this week.
Don't even get me started. I can't believe he did that.
I can't
either. I mean, I can.
Adam, how do you feel about this reveal of these two being the killers?
I have a bigger issue with
All right. Scale of 1 to 10, boys. Wow, I am interested. I don't know where either of you are going to land. Well, I'm mad a little bit because we did this.
So save me for second.
I am. Of course I am. I always save you for second. Unlike you. With me. Scale of 1 to 10, what do we give Scream?
All right, that's enough. That'll be a wrap. The sequel discussion to be continued.